Welcome to The Investment Conversation, Lord Abbott's ongoing podcast series.
This is Will Andrews, digital editor for Lord Abbott. Growth stocks have long been a specialty here at Lord Abbott as we've developed a differentiated approach that's historically had success over the years. Joining me today to take a deeper dive on our growth investing playbook is Lord Abbott equity investment strategist Brian Forster. Great to have you here today, Brian.
Great. Thank you, Will. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Growth stocks have long been a focus of investors, but despite the success growth has enjoyed from an investment perspective, recent data from Strategic Insights show that it's the equity mutual fund category with the largest net outflows over the past decade. What's going on there? Why have they fallen out of favor?
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating, isn't it? I would say since the financial crisis, we've definitely seen a big pickup in mutual fund outflows. But it really began, if you go back to all the way back to the dot-com bubble and the bursting of that. And a lot of things happened in 2002, 2003 that really created a headwind for just risk appetite in general. We would call that from a behavioral standpoint, myopic loss aversion, meaning that investors have become so attuned to their year-to-year returns and less attuned to what they should be doing over the long run, which is thinking about long-term wealth creation. So areas like large cap growth, mid cap growth, or really any areas of the equity asset class that typically have higher volatility have really been put to the side in favor of more short-term oriented or lower volatility strategies. And if you think about a few things that have happened over the past 16 or 17 years, the biggest area of product proliferation has really been low vol equity strategies and smart beta strategies. So again, areas that are intended to generate or sort of orchestrate lower volatility. The second was, if you go back to 2002 through 2006, in the institutional area, the Pension Protection Act and FAS 158, which is a pretty obscure accounting rule, but it had a very big impact, really focused institutions on mark-to-market accounting instead of what they had done prior to 2000, which was investing for the long term and owning a lot more equities. And as we mentioned, the biggest area of mutual fund outflows has been in the large cap growth asset class, followed second by mid-cap growth and third in small cap growth. So really growth has been really largely ignored, if not really run away from over the past decade. But as you point out, it's been the best performing part of the equity market.
Well, it's funny. There are some other interesting trends in growth. The indexing phenomenon has made some real inroads into, you know, growth equities. You know, even with the outflows, it's still a very popular vehicle. But how would you characterize those growth indexes? Are they truly representative of what people think of when they think of growth equity?
The one caveat to my prior answer would have been an indexing, right? You have seen better flows into index strategies just specifically for the fees, right? Because they're very cheap. When you dig into, let's say, the largest index for growth, which would be the Russell 1000 Growth Index, yes, you see Facebook in there, you see Amazon, you see Netflix. But in the top 20, I think a lot of investors would be surprised to see what else they see in there. So you have names like Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Altria, McDonald's. And I like to joke with our internal wholesalers that I don't really think that cigarettes, soda, and burgers are the biggest growth industries today in the U.S. economy, but yet they have very large stakes in the index. You also look at the largest name, Apple. Now, Apple, of course, is one of the most successful companies in our lifetime, and it mm-hmm. still is one of the great companies out there today, but it's really become much more of a value stock. Certainly when Warren Buffett starts making big bets on a name, it is a value stock in our opinion. It has a very low sales growth rate as compared to about 5 years ago, and yet it's the largest name in the index. So my point is, when you own the Russell 1000 Growth Index, whether it's an ETF or an index fund, you really want to make sure that you don't have the exact same holdings in a value portfolio that you also have in your overall allocation. So we do think that indexing in this space is fraught with a lot of problems mm-hmm. and that you really should be looking more for high growth to complement your value allocation.
And it's really, I guess, a question of knowing what you own.
Exactly.
So how do you define high growth?
When we look at sort of criteria for what makes a great high growth company, we think about something called operating momentum. We want to see things like high revenue growth. And in the small cap space, you can actually see accelerating revenue growth where a company grows 30%, 50%. It's pretty rare, but you can find it. Now, as you move up the market cap spectrum, that's almost impossible to continue generating those types of accelerating revenue growth paces. But what you can see are companies sustaining a high level of growth for much longer than the market expects? And this is really a big bias in this space, is that, you know, the typical sell side analyst, or just the typical way of thinking about stocks, is that they simply must slow as they get larger. And certainly as you get very large, it is impossible to sustain a high growth rate. But there are many names. I mean, if you think about Netflix over the past 5, 6, 7 years, they have constantly surprised people to the upside at how long they can sustain their high level of revenue growth. And part of it's because they kept reinventing themselves.
There's no assurance they're gonna keep doing that, but it's definitely been a characteristic of their performance over time.
Exactly. It's not a call on the future, but I think a lot of investors have been surprised to see companies like that. And there are dozens of them over the past decade that have, you know, certainly the FANG stocks became FANG because of how long they could sustain their high revenue growth. Things like high margin strength, the ability to generate high gross margins. Now, that's a big difference from net margins. Amazon didn't turn a profit until a few years ago, but their stock did pretty well over the past 17 years. I think it went from a split-adjusted level of $5 a share to $1,700 of a share over those 15 years, all the while reinvesting aggressively for growth. So we like to see companies that reinvest for growth much more than we'd like to see them rush to profitability. We like to see instances where the largest or the fastest growing component of its business line, maybe it's a small component today, but it, you know, over the very short period of time, it becomes a big or prominent part of their overall operating revenues. And then lastly, just the definition of operating momentum, if you look in sort of the classic textbook definition, is the tendency for sell-side analysts to have to constantly have to catch up to a company's growth. And so earnings revisions is something we look at as well.
So you mentioned operating momentum, but we've also spoken about the role of price momentum in a growth equity strategy. Give us the basics on that. Why is it so important to track price momentum?
Yeah, I mean, price momentum really is a reflection of a very large investor bias, and that is called the disposition effect, or the tendency of investors to sell stocks too quickly because they just believe in mean reversion. A lot of academic work has been done around the momentum factor. And actually, academia has been very late to really being able to explain why this factor is so persistent. It's actually been practitioners who were ahead of the curve, if you will. If you go back to, say, the 1980s, and great hedge fund investors like Paul Tudor Jones used to famously use momentum as a way, not as a trading strategy, but as a way to sort of confirm his fundamental thesis. And he used to say, losers average losers. He didn't want to be betting against stocks that were going down and trying to pick a bottom. He wanted to own winning stocks and continue to add to those as they go up, which is really contrary to the traditional orthodoxy of equity investing. If you go back to sort of the Graham Dodd or the Warren Buffett more recently approach, you want to do all the work up front, research these very mature companies, figure out which ones are trading at the biggest discount, and then own them for a very long period of time, 5, 7 years. That can work really well in the value space. In the high growth space, you're dealing with companies that are really rapidly growing. Many of them have negative earnings, and many may not make it. And the punishment for being wrong can be massive. If you think about a biotech company going through drug trials, and there may be a binary outcome, you don't want to be just pounding the table saying, I'm right and the market's wrong, while the stock loses 90%. So we think price momentum can confirm a fundamental thesis. What also causes investors to avoid momentum might just be the lack of rigor around the factor. It's a very simplistic sounding factor. And because all you're really looking at is, you know, whatever stocks did best over the prior 12 months will continue to do best over the next 12, and then vice versa for the worst performing stocks. But it does tend to work. If you look at sort of the FAMA French studies or work that Cliff Asness has done more recently, the momentum factor has really been the most persistent and powerful factor over, say, the value factor, over small versus large or international versus domestic. What it's famous for, though, unfortunately, are the momentum crashes like we saw in 1999, again in 08. Then we had a defensives crash in 09 as high beta stocks rallied off the bottom. And then in Q4 of 18, we had a sort of a mini momentum crash, which causes investors to just say, I don't want any part of that. And we certainly don't want a whole big part of that either as equity managers, which is why we use technical analysis to complement our fundamental approach. Because we do think if you use different forms of momentum analysis. So say absolute price momentum, which is also known as time series momentum, where you're measuring the stock momentum of a company versus its own price history, as well as relative momentum, measuring it against the entire rest of the market. You can really identify signals that can help you get out of the way of momentum crashes, but also capturing the upside of that factor over the longer term. So we really like it as a tool for the high growth investor.
Brian, the word disruptor seems to come up a lot in growth stock conversations. Some of the most transformative companies on the planet, Netflix and PayPal are two good examples, started out as small, scrappy outsiders before they made their mark. Where are today's disruptors?
Well, really, you can find them in many places. So a lot of unicorns out there in the private market that potentially could go public, over the next year or two that would be classified as innovators and disruptors. In the public markets, you can really find them up and down the market cap range. We think there's a lot of fertile ground in small cap growth biotech. We're seeing a lot of companies on the tech side staying private longer, but in biotech, you're seeing a lot of companies come to market right away. They need the funding for R&D, and you see a lot of disruptive technologies and a lot of very promising drugs coming to market today. And by contrast, if you look at large cap biopharmaceuticals, they're almost now rushing to acquire some of these drugs and drug companies. A lot of those now have gone generic, and they need to own companies that have much higher growth rates that you're finding in the small and mid cap. Since the decoding of the human genome, we've seen an explosion in successful drug launches and a lot more breakthroughs, which could turn a lot of deadly diseases today into chronic or even cured diseases tomorrow. So we're very excited about that space. It's probably the earliest stage part of the areas of innovation that we look at. Certainly internet software, information security, e-commerce, of course, all of those are areas of disruption that we love today, but it's very important to be very active in this space, or else some of the disruptors that you're owning could be disrupted very quickly by a new entrant. So we believe in a very active approach, and we're looking to really capture just the fastest growing part of a company's life cycle.
Let's kind of wrap things up here. Let's say that we have a 40-story elevator ride together, maybe a couple of stops along the way. Give me a summary of your approach to growth investing before the doors open.
Sure. So I'll just reiterate one point that we started with in this conversation, and that is we do have some equity risk, right? And we think that investors have spent the better part of the past two decades trying to get away from equity risk, and we think that's unfortunate because we never entered that period of low returns, and we don't think that's coming anytime soon, certainly not with 2% inflation, very low interest rates, but still a positive economy. And this age of innovation that we're living in with unprecedented growth, we think this is a great time for growth investing. Now, with that said, our process is very focused on three things. We want to own disruptors and superior businesses, and so we went through some of the metrics that we think about, whether that's strong revenue growth, strong operating margins, a growth in a company's total addressable market, and constant earnings revisions. So we want to own a very specific type of company. We also want to make sure that they have operating momentum. There's a lot of geniuses out there that have great concepts, but they're not executing well. We want to see that a company is seeing a surge in its operating momentum. And then the third piece of the puzzle is owning stocks of these companies that have very strong price momentum. We don't want to be trying to catch a falling knife. We're not trying to see around the corner and figure out which company is going to turn around. We want to own companies that have great fundamentals, but also are starting to experience very strong price momentum. We think that's the way that you capture the bulk of the upside, but you also identify momentum crashes and avoid the downside.
This is a really dynamic and fascinating corner of the investment world, and you've really brought us a lot of great information today. So thanks for being with us today, Brian.
Great. Thanks, Will.
That's it for this edition of The Investment Conversation. Please drop us a line on social media or visit our website at lordabbott.com. Our audio podcasts are available on iTunes, Spotify, TuneIn, and other major streaming media services. Thanks for listening.
Additional disclosure for this podcast. FAS 158 is an accounting standard that covers defined benefit pension and other post-retirement plans.
Beta is a measure of the volatility or systematic risk of a security or a portfolio in comparison to the entire market or a benchmark. The Russell 1000 Growth Index measures the performance of those Russell 1000 companies with higher price-to-book ratios and higher forecasted growth values. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. The value of investments in equity securities will fluctuate in response to general economic conditions and to changes in the prospects of particular companies and/or sectors in the economy. No investing strategy can overcome all market volatility or guarantee future results. Market forecasts and projections are based on current market conditions and are subject to change without notice. Projections should not be considered a guarantee. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbott speaker are those of the speaker as of the date of the broadcast and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. Any such views are subject to change at any time based upon market or other conditions, and Lord Abbott disclaims any responsibility to update such views. This material is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, or investment advice. It is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities, or to adopt any investment strategy. Neither Lord Abbott nor the Lord Abbott speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered. The information provided is not directed at any investor or category of investors and is provided solely as general information about Lord Abbott's products and services and to otherwise provide general investment education. None of the information provided should be regarded as a suggestion to engage in or refrain from any investment-related course of action, as neither Lord Abbott nor its affiliates are undertaking to provide impartial investment advice, act as an impartial advisor, or give advice in a fiduciary capacity. If you are an individual retirement investor, contact your financial advisor or other fiduciary about whether any given investment idea, strategy, product, or service may be appropriate for your circumstances. This broadcast is the copyright 2019 of Lord Abbott & Company, LLC. All rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or any form without the permission of Lord Abbott. Lord Abbott Mutual Funds are distributed by Lord Abbott Distributor, LLC.